We were at last week, we went to Perek Yud Aleph, more or less, which is one of the most dramatic and somewhat controversial chapters in Daniel, if not in Tanakh, because of the detail with which he describes events that are still in the future. The classic interpretation amongst the Mefarshim, and I think I mentioned this last week, the traditional parshanut of Daniel has this story split, part of it dealing with the Chashmonaim Greece and Alexander the Great and the aftermath, and part of it dealing with a much further ahead piece of history, namely the Roman conquest of Israel and then eventually Yemot HaMashiach. Our take on much of Daniel has been to kind of narrow our scope and focus specifically to the immediate future of Daniel's timetable, meaning to look forward to Yavan. He doesn't mention any name of any nation beyond Persia, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. And so our assumption is that this nevuah is about Yavan, about Greece itself. And it really took us from Alexander the Great through till Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, which really is the focus of this perek. And we kind of went through till the end of the perek, but I want to pick up a piece of the story from Pasuk Chaf Chet and on, where Antiochus had kind of tried to negotiate with or try to engage with the south one more time and was unsuccessful. And so the pasuk says, "V'yashov arzo b'ruchush gadol ulevavo al brit kodesh," and return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall turn against the holy covenant. V'yasa v'shav le'arzo. And what I want to pick up on is the number of references here in this text, and he makes to what's going on in the land of Israel, specifically with regards to the Jewish people. Because ultimately, a nevuah about Antiochus is irrelevant to us. What's really relevant is the impact that it has for the Jewish people. This is, again, the Malach speaking to Daniel, and he's going to talk about, Daniel, your people. And that's really the issue here. Uva lamoed yeshuv uva b'negev, point of time he shall return and come to the south. Velotia kadishana v'achona, but not like the first time. Ba'ol bo kitziim kitim minich'ah, he ships from kitim will come against him and he will be defeated. V'shav v'za'am al brit kodesh, and he shall return and be angry and be enraged at the holy covenant. V'yasan, take action. V'shav v'yaven, and he shall return and show regard to al ozvei brit kodesh, those who forsake the holy covenant. So we have the anger at the holy covenant, and we have those who abandon the holy covenant. Za'am al brit kodesh and ozvei brit kodesh. Uzra'im mimenu ya'amodu, powerful forces shall arise from him. V'chillelu hamikdash hamaoz, they shall profane the sanctuary. V'esiru atamid, they will remove the daily burnt offering from the operations of the mikdash. V'natnu hashikutz mishomem, and in its place shall place a disgusting or abomination, meaning an idol. U'mashi'ei brit, and those who are wicked against the covenant, yachnif b'chalakot, they shall bladder with smooth talk. The am yodei Elohav yachaziku v'asu, but the people that know God, they shall show strength and they shall prevail. Umaskilei am, those who are wise amongst the people, yavinu l'rabim, they shall teach to the many. V'nichshelu b'cherev uvalehava b'shviu v'viza b'yamim, and they shall for a time stumble by the sword and by the flame, captivity and spoil. Ubehi kashlam, but as they stumble, ye azru ezer ma'at, they shall be helped. V'nilvu alehem rabim b'chalakot, and many shall join them, even with smooth talk. Umin hamaskilim, and of those who are wise, yikashlu nitzrof behem ulevarer ulelaben ad etkets, they shall, those that are why shall stumble to refine them and to purify them and to make them white until the future time. Again, we've translated eight kates differently. There is yet time to come. And this king, there's a little bit of a reference. The rest of the story kind of shifts back to Antiochus. This king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself, magnify himself over every god. He shall speak wondrous things against the God of gods. He shall prosper until the time of the wrath is completed. For that which is decreed shall be done. And without regard to the God of his fathers, we read this last week, I'm just going to running through a little bit of it. He shall not have no regards for the gods of his fathers, the desire, etc. The rest of this parak comes back to the wars of Nebuchadnezzar, Antiochus and the king of the north and king of the south. I'm going to skip for a moment. Just want to point out another reference to Be'et Ketz, the time of this is happening. Yitnagachim HaMelech HaNegev, more battles between the king of the north and king of the south. And Baba Eretz HaTzvi, he'll come back to the beautiful land, which of course, again, a reference to the land of Israel. V'rabot yikashelu. These shall be rescued from his hand, Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And the rest of this parak deals with the continuation of the battles with the south. And the question that I really wanted to pose, and that's really where we're going to pick up the story, is if this in fact is a reference to Antiochus and the story of Hanukkah, that's really what this is about. There are enough hints here that what we're dealing with is the story of the revolt of the Maccabees and the story of Hanukkah. Go back to the text here and just take a look at how many times he refers to things like Brit Kodesh, Antiochus's war against the Holy Covenant, which he makes reference to in Pasuk Chav Chet, and then again in Pasuk Chavtet or Lamed, Lamoed Yeshub Benegev, Uvala Bekitzim, etc. Vishav Bezaam al Brit Kodesh. And then he makes reference to those who abandon the Brit Kodesh, al Ozve Brit Kodesh. We're going to talk about that in a second. He makes reference to Marshi Ebrit, those who act wickedly against the covenant. He talks about two different groups within the people of Israel. Maskile Am, those who are wise, those who understand, and Am Yodei Olahav, those who are part of the people who know God, in comparison or in contrast to the Marshi'e Brit. He makes reference to Rishaim, the wicked, and who will come with smooth talk. All of these are hints to essentially one major theme, which is when Antiochus enters into the land of Israel, he's going to find in there a internal conflict between those who are loyal to the Brit and those who have abandoned it or those who have rebelled against it. And into that mix, or because of Antiochus's presence, that mix will become even more intense. And he continues that theme into the next parak, which is really part of the same nevuah. So I'm going to jump to parak Yudbet, although the website is slow today. I don't know why. My picture you see, right? I'm not sure why this is. This is at the.
This is the type of stuff that Andy is going to want to see.
That's not good. This technology is now out of my hands. This is now the website. Come on.
Very refreshing. It.
I did.
It's a very old text. It takes time to get moving, you know.
Site can't be reached. Okay, let's do this again. No, not quite sure. I apologize.
Is that what you're thinking about, Dave?
Neo. Very good bet. Okay, well, we're going to have to do this differently.
Is the text in the handout?
This, no, this is not.
Oh, okay.
But we will just do it. Don't like to use Sophia for this purpose, but. All right. It's not laid out as nicely as I would have liked, but okay. This is Perek Yudbet, continuing again in the same prophecy. Uve'etahi Ya'amod Michael Hasad HaGadol Ha'omed Al Bnei Amecha. Remember that it's Gavil's the Malach talking to Daniel, and he says at that time, Michael, your prince, the Tsar of the Jewish people, Michael, will come v'hayta et tzara. It will be a time of great trouble. Greatest trouble from the time that Israel had become a nation. At that time, your people shall be spared, or shall be rescued, all that are found inscribed in the book. We'll talk about that at another time. Many of those that sleep in the dust of the earth will awaken. Some to eternal life, others to reproach and everlasting abhorrence. Somebody asked me before about the reference to Olam Haba, which appears seem to allude to reference here in some capacity, or to Tchiyat HaMetim more specifically. The Maskilim, again, that same reference to the Maskilim, those who understand. Yaziru Kizor HaRakia, they shall be radiant and bright like the expanse of the sky. And those who lead the many to righteousness shall be like the stars forever and ever. And again, we have this reference to this conflict within the Jewish people that will come to a head in the experience, in the time frame of these events that we are describing in the story of Antiochus and the story of the Chashmonaim. Daniel, as for you, Daniel, stom hadvarim, keep it secret. V'chatom ha-sefer adet ketz, and seal the book until the time of the end. Yishototu rabim v'tirbedad, many will range far and wide, and knowledge will increase, and then you can share this information. V'it yani Daniel v'nei shnayim machem yomdim, I looked and I saw two others standing there. Echad yehena l'sfati or, v'chad yehena l'sfati or, one on one bank of the river, one on the other. I said to the man clothed in linen, or was above the waters, Ad matai, Ketzaplot, when is all this thing going to happen? Then the man took an oath and he swore by the ever living one. There's that time and a half we talked about way back at the beginning of the Sefer. When the breaking of the power of the holy people comes to an end, these things shall be fulfilled. I had heard this. I didn't understand. What is the time? What is this future? Go, Daniel, these things are secret and sealed to the time of the, or to the appointed time. Many will be purified and purged and refined. And the wicked will be wicked. And they will not understand. But the ones who are righteous, they will understand. מעת יוסר התמיד ולתת שיקוץ שמם ימים 1290. From the time that the Tamid is abolished, we spoke about earlier, right, that the Antiochus will abolish the daily offering and replace it with an abomination of Zeus, latet shikutz v'shamem, yamim 1290, they will be 1290. The calculation we talked about way back at the beginning of the Sefer. Ashrei mechakev yagia liyamim 1335. Happy is the one who waits to reach 1,335 days. Yata lech leketz v'tanoch v'tamod l'goralcha leketz hayamin. You now go to your end and rise to your destiny at the time that is appointed. Okay. So what I want to basically take a step back for and understand is that without getting into all the details, and we'll talk next week about this whole reference to Tchiyat HaMetim and Olam Haba and all of those esoteric concepts. We'll kind of unpack them, Bezrat Hashem, as best we can in the last year. But today what I really wanted to ask and to understand is, why is Daniel talking about Hanukkah? Why, of all the events in Jewish history, which is not in Tanakh, right? Hanukkah is post-Tanakh event. Daniel is the latest reference we have in Tanakh, and the latest reference to kind of allude to in a hint to this concept of Hanukkah. We have references to, I'm going to actually stop sharing for a moment because I don't think, I don't think I can go back. Let's see if I can get back to Allah Torah now. Let's see if it will behave. But the question that I really wanted to struggle with today is, why Hanukkah? My high. All the references. Why is Daniel connected to Hanukkah? And I would argue, and I think that this is brought out in much of what we have studied. No, not going to work. Which is that Daniel kind of, all of the whole Sefer has been kind of leading up to this point. And we're going to sort of draw the connections and draw the pieces together in a minute. But we saw back in the very first prophecy about Nebuchadnezzar's dream, where he talked about the different components of the statue. And we alluded then to the fact that the clay and the iron may be a reference to the split of the kingdom of the Greeks in the aftermath of Alexander the Great. We saw later on the end of Persia and the rise of Yavan referenced in an earlier division about the great animal with the horns. And the horns that divide up into 10 horns, that might also be a reference to Alexander the Great's kingdom being divided up. There's so many hints throughout the Sefer from the very beginning that there is a focus of Sefer Daniel to get us to this point. And this point being a point in which we recognize where we can articulate at this point, we're post-Babylonians, we're post-Persians, we're sitting at the edge of the transition between Babel and Persia, between Persia and Greece. And now he can kind of spell out the fact that this story of Antiochus is going to lead to a conflict between those who are loyal to the Brit and those who have abandoned the Brit. Those who are loyal to the Brit Kodesh and those who are Ozvei Brit Kodesh. He's going to talk about Marshi'ei Brit and Ozvei Brit, those who abandon the covenant and those who are loyal to it, those who are maskilim, those who understand. And those maskilim am, they understand and they will teach and they will inspire and they will slip and they will fall and they will sacrifice and they will have to be kind of brought, supported. And all of this is, of course, the story of Chashmonaim. This is really the story of Hanukkah. So I guess the real question that we need to, and again, the classic Mefarshim, the classic Parshanut, saw these references and interpreted them as kind of eschatological and talking about Yemot HaMashiach and the Romans and then post the Romans, etc. But in terms of our understanding of the Sefer, it's really about the Greeks and therefore about Hanukkah. And the question, I guess, that we need to kind of pull together is, of all the events of Jewish history, why is Daniel so focused on understanding, predicting, and sharing with us in advance a kind of a picture of the conflict of the Hashmonaim and the Mityavnim, between the Greeks and the Hellenists and the Hasidim, or the story of Hanukkah and the revolt of the Maccabees. So to put this in perspective, I want to share with you several possibilities, and we kind of need to move forward in time a little bit and put ourselves into the story of Hanukkah. And there's a number of different vantage points, or a number of different perspectives on the story of Hanukkah that are unique, and that for Daniel were critically important for him to share with us in advance. And that's really where our story is going to take us today. I'll get to the source page in a moment, but
is it heretical to suggest that Daniel was written after Hanukkah and that it's
well, it would, heretical is a big word. It certainly doesn't fit the position of Chazal that places the end of prophecy around the time of Chag HaZechariah Malachi and Daniel being earlier. Whether there's one Daniel or two Daniels is a debate between traditional Mefarshim and academics. There's certainly a sort of academic or perspective within the world of Parshanut and biblical criticism that says that there's, the second Daniel is much later in the period of the Greeks from the aftermath, and he's writing in hindsight. But the text is not written in hindsight. The text is written as a foreshadowing, as a prophecy of his vision of the future. So is the text lying to us, right? Is Daniel really looking at this in the past, but he's presenting it to us of the future? I'm not comfortable with that kind of approach. So is there such a position out there? Yes. So would it fit the world of the Beit Midrash? Not in my worldview. But
there is a method as to whether Daniel was a Navi or not. And maybe
yes, but that's a separate issue. That's because he's in Chutz La'aretz. I don't think that would have, right? He's in Tanakh, and Tanakh is closed at a certain period of time. The Book of the Maccabees is not in Tanakh because it's considered to be later than the story of the closing of Tanakh. So to put Daniel there and not the Book of the Maccabees, I'm not comfortable with that position. It exists. I'm not sure I would I would not personally subscribe to that approach. It exists. I won't deny that it exists, but I would for now suggest that my approach to the understanding of the Sefer is different, and I think there's legitimate interpretation here that suggests that in advance of the events of Hanukkah, the story of Daniel was a kind of a groundwork necessary for us to navigate through Hanukkah, and that's really what I want to suggest, that when you look at the story of Daniel against as part of the backdrop of the struggle of Hanukkah, suddenly new things emerge. For example, let's first recognize the fact that Hellenism and the conflict with the Greeks presented a completely radical and new kind of challenge for Israel. The Greeks were not the Babylonians and they were not the Persians. And they were not the Arameans or any other nation that existed, or Assyrians existed in the time of Tanakh. The Greeks were different. And what made them different was in many things, but particularly one thing that I think stands out for us and for our understanding of the Sefer, what made them different was that the Babylonians essentially were a conquering army. They were an army that had national aspirations to conquer and to eradicate all national identity. So there was no escape that once the Babylonians marched through, there was no alternative to Babylonian conquest. The similarly with the Persians. The Persians' issue with the Jewish people was not national in that regard. It was much more anti-Semitic in the classic sense of anti-Semitism, meaning Haman's description of his anger to Israel was, you were Jew, you were considered beyond the pale for Haman. Right? There was no negotiating kind of position that says, okay, well, if I do this, I can join you or not join you, or stay Jewish or stay independent. The Greeks were different, because by the time the Greeks come through the land of Israel, the goal was a cultural goal, meaning they didn't have aspirations to remove the Jewish identity of the Jewish kingdom, etc. They wanted simply to establish a kind of Hellenistic world of a cultural identity. And so suddenly it became an option for many to remain in Israel, to remain part of the nation of Israel, to remain part of the Jewish people and part of the Jewish kingdom, and yet to join with the conquering forces culturally, not necessarily nationally. That was a new formula for us. Hang on one second. I just need to take care of one thing. Sorry about that. It became possible to make the argument that you can be part of the Jewish people and still culturally side with the conquering army of the Greeks. That created, of course, what Daniel describes as those who are Ozvei Brit, those who abandon the covenant, those who are Mashiei Brit, whereas against those who are loyal to the Brit Kodesh. This was a whole new formula for us. It was the first time we had encountered a conquering army that essentially placed the culture, the spiritual center of our identity as part of that conflict. And now splitting the people apart in terms of the option to remain in Israel and to remain Jewish and to remain independent, etc., but simply to culturally side with the Hellenists or with the Greeks. And that's the story of the internal conflict with Israel. That's a very different formula. And so our ability to withstand most of the way Tanakh perceives these conflicts is that the Navi sets the stage for the variables necessary for us to be able to navigate through them. So it requires a Daniel kind of setting the stage for the ability to recognize that such a cultural battle exists, and to lay the groundwork for those who want to remain loyal to Torah and to the Brit, and to say, okay, we're going to follow the path set by Daniel. And I'll show you actually references in the story of Hanukkah where Daniel is mentioned as a kind of a paradigm for them in their struggle. Daniel also mentions quite clearly various aspects of the struggle that the maskilim or the maskileim are going to have, even to the point of sacrificing their lives for suffering because of their loyalty to the Brit. That's also new. Sefer Daniel itself placed before us a whole new concept. If we go back to the stories we've studied over the course of this, more or less this year, right? If we go back to all of, from the very beginning of the Sefer, there was an underlining theme that carried through the stories of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Daniel and his friends from Perek Aleph, where they were placed in a position where they had to eat the king's food and they didn't want to. And so they negotiated for the ability to eat seeds instead of food, the Patpag HaMelech, right? They put their lives on the line for what would be ostensibly not one of the big three. And we spent a good number of of classes discussing halachically, philosophically, what does it mean for them to risk their lives for what was not idolatry or not one of the big three, right? They risked their lives for kashrus. They risked their, I'm talking about in Sefer Daniel. They risked their lives for national identity, Hanani Meshav Azayir, refusing to bow down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, even though it wasn't idolatry. Or Daniel risking his life for prayer for the sake of the redemption of Israel and the national connection to the Jewish people, or a sense of pride in being. These were moments in which they put their lives on the line for not the big three, but because for Daniel's worldview, they were issues that cut to the core, what we would call in halachic terminology, we would call Shat Hashmad, right? Times when the enemies are coming against Israel and trying to challenge us religiously, and we therefore have a responsibility and an obligation and a right to defend ourselves in that regard, even at the risk of our own lives. That's a new concept in Tanakh. It's a concept introduced in Sefer Daniel, who's a group of Jews struggling in a foreign culture, and now it lays the groundwork for the story of Hanukkah. Because how many times in the story of Hanukkah did we read in the Book of the Maccabees and in the various Midrashim about the event, or various stories and legends about Hanukkah, of Jews and the Hashmonaim giving, risking their lives for non-idolatry-based moments. Let's go back to the share screen for a second. Okay, so this is the source page that I shared with you. I pulled a couple of examples. Now, there are many. Now, Book of the Maccabees is very controversial in many ways. The first and the second book of the Maccabees is probably less controversial and more historical. The third and the fourth books of the Maccabees are much later works. They're controversial in terms of their authorship and their authenticity. But for my purposes, what I really wanted to show you is the number of times the substance of risking one's life for non-idolatry-based religious life, the notion of what we call Shat Hashmad because of religious persecution, is at the core of the story of Hanukkah. It's at the core of the story of Daniel. We never had that until Daniel. We looked at that and said, well, this is new. You can't risk your life for tefillah. Tefillah is not one of the big three. Well, Daniel could, because the circumstances were unique. So too for Kasha, so too for other examples. We looked at the statement of Rabbi Yochanan. This is going back, this is the last kind of a quick review. But right, Rabbi Yochanan says that the only three transgressions that a person is allowed to give their life for are Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shefichas Damim, idolatry, sexual relations, and bloodshed. And then the Gemara says, Amar Abdimi, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Lo Shenu Ela Shelo B'Shat Hashmad, that's only if it's not a time of religious persecution. But if it's a time of religious persecution, then for any mitzvah, a person is allowed to give their life. That's a unique perspective of Rabbi Yochanan. Where does it come from? It comes from, it emerges from this, the experience of Daniel and his friends. That we've established many times in the course of our study of the Sefer. Suddenly you get to the story of Hanukkah, and you read about the Book of the Maccabees. Many in Israel, in keeping with the king's order, this is in chapter one, the events that led to the revolt. Women who had their children circumcised were put to death. With babies hung from the necks, they also killed their families and plundered those who had circumcised them. And many in Israel gained might and resolved in their hearts not to eat anything common, which is a translation of non-kosher food. They preferred to die rather than to be defiled by the food, by food, or to profane the holy covenant. And they died. Meaning, suddenly, they're dying for Brit Milah. They're dying for, because of the persecutions of Antiochus. They're dying for kashrus. These are not some of the big three. They would never have been part of the conversation had not there been already a precedent in the story of Daniel. Here's another interesting event in the same chapter, chapter one of the Book of the Maccabees, which Daniel alludes to when he talks about those who are loyal to the Brit having kind of a setback and because of the Brit. It's a very famous story in which when the initial revolt started, the Greek said, enough of this, now come out and obey the king. The Jews were hiding in a cave, and it was Shabbos, and the Jews said, we will not come out, nor will we obey the king's account to profane the day of the Sabbath. So the enemy hastened to war against them. But the Jews, they did not retaliate, nor did they throw stones, nor block up their own hiding places. They literally passively sat there in the caves and allowed themselves to be slaughtered because it was Shabbos. And they said, let us die in innocence. The heaven and the earth testify in our behalf that you destroy us unjustly. So the officers and soldiers raised up a war against them on the Sabbaths, and they died along with the women and the children and the livestock to a number of 1,000 souls. When Matityahu and his friends learned about this, they mourned deeply for them. And one man said to the other, if we all do as our brothers have done and do not war against the nations for our souls and our traditions, they will soon destroy us from the earth. And on that day, they took counsel, saying, let us make a war against every human who wars against us on the day of the Sabbath. They've made a decree that you're allowed to defend your life. If you're an army and it's Shabbos, you can defend yourself. That we take that for granted today. The Israeli army wouldn't survive a week if we didn't have such a position. But this was new to them. This was unique. So that we may not all die as our brothers died in hiding places. This is the maskileam saying, we recognize that there are unique circumstances here. That's exactly what Daniel is talking about. There is, of course, the very famous story of it's somewhat of an apocryphal story. It's referred to as Chana and his seven sons. It's whether it's Chana, whether it's seven sons, whether it really happened, or whether it's a later story. It's in the book. It's referenced in the second book of the Maccabees, the third book, the fourth. It's referenced in a number and some Midrashic legends. I'm not so concerned about the historicity of whether, in fact, it happened as much as the way the text presents it. And that's what we wanted to show you. As it happened, seven brothers and their mother were arrested and tormented with whips and scourges by the king to force them to eat illegal swine meat. In other words, the issue at hand is not idolatry, and it's not murder, and it's not adultery. The issue at hand is kashrus. But one of them acting as the spokesman... One of them acting as the spokesman said, what do you expect to ask and learn from us? For we are ready to die rather than transgress the laws of God received from our forefathers. Similarly, there is a in the book of in book four, again, book three and book four, historically controversial and complicated, but this is just a fascinating reference. This is a speech attributed to the mother of these seven sons, who says in her speech, for him also our father Abraham was zealous to sacrifice Isaac, our progenitor, and didn't shudder at the sight of his own paternal hand descending down with a sword upon him. The righteous Daniel was cast to the lions. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael were hurled into a fiery furnace, yet they endured through God. You then, having the same faith toward God, do not be troubled, she says to her sons. So suddenly, Daniel and the story of the lions and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and the story of the fiery furnace are paradigms of Mesirut Nefesh and the ability, the strength of Mesirut Nefesh in the face of religious persecution. This is brand new. In Tanakh, you don't have such a precedent. There's nowhere else in Tanakh where you have a nation saying, if you don't abandon your religious actions, we will kill you. Otherwise, we'll let you live. And them giving their lives rather than allowing them to be persecuted. It starts with Daniel and his friends in exile. It starts the story of Galut Bavel. And now here, suddenly we have the Jews in Israel in the time of the Hashmonaim. And they're borrowing the same tropes and the same Mesirut Nefesh and the same strength from Sefer Daniel. This is why I think Daniel was always understood contemporarily, was understood as a text which brought strength to the people in the face of the similar kind of circumstances that they felt that they faced in exile. Here now suddenly they're facing in the land of Israel. There's another story that appears in in the third book of the Maccabees. Talks about a certain man amongst the priests, a scribe by the name of Eleazar. And again, he's kind of placed in this position where he's being forced to eat non-kosher meat. And he makes an impassioned plea or an impassioned prayer. He talks about God who took us out of Egypt, the seed of Abraham, and etc. He talks about Pharaoh who made multiplication of chariots, and Sancheriv who brought a number of forces against us, kind of going through history. And at the end of it, he writes, the three comrades in Bavel who voluntarily given their souls into a fire so as not to venerate the vain things, you rescued unharmed. So he's got the story a little bit inaccurate, but nonetheless, you rescued unharmed even to a hair. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word, bedewing the extremely fiery furnace and turning it aflame against all of their opponents. Daniel, who through the slanders of envy was hurled down into the earth of the lions as food for beasts, and you led to the light unharmed. Also Jonah. So again, you have this theme that runs through Daniel and that becomes so central to the strength of the revolt of the Maccabees and the revolt of the people and the loyalty of the Hashmonaim and the followers, the Hasidim, to the covenant in face of an army or in face of a culture that was saying to them, just become like Greeks, just become like us, and we will support you. There was internal struggle between the Kohanim, the Kohanim who wanted to become Hellenists and who were Hellenists, who kind of sold themselves to Greek, to Antiochus, as lots recorded in the Book of the Maccabees. All of this is kind of one of the most tumultuous moments in the beginning, towards the beginning of the Second Temple period. Comes along Sefer Daniel and serves as a foundational support, spiritual, emotional support to these who are loyal, to those who are loyal to the Brit, as Daniel himself describes, maskilei am, those who are committed to the covenant, those who are committed to the Brit. This is at the core of what Hanukkah is about. It goes one step further even, and this is really where it gets into its most controversial aspect. What Daniel sets in place as an unprecedented paradigm, not only is loyalty to the Brit at a time when the persecution is against the Brit, not against the people, but Daniel goes one step further. Because Daniel establishes the notion of being willingly put their lives at risk for this kind of loyalty, the notion of Shaat Hashmad, and that takes on a whole new level in the events of Hanukkah. Not only were they persecuted for their beliefs, not only and for their loyalty to the Brit, but there were moments when they were literally had to sacrifice themselves for that Brit. That's a Akedas Yitzchak moment. That's what Elazar was describing here when he makes reference to the Akedah or the mother to her sons. Right? And that becomes part of the religious, cultural, halachic frame of reference in the Second Temple period. What the Gemara here refers to in Sanhedrin as Shaat Hashmad, the Gemara in Gittin tells a story, extraordinary story. An incident involving 400 boys and girls who were taken as captives for the purpose of prostitution. And they were on the boat, on the sea. They knew what was happening. Amru, they said, Imanu tovim bayam, if we drown at the sea, anu ba'im l'chaye olam haba. If we drown at the sea, essentially we jump into the sea or commit suicide to drown on the sea, then we will achieve an eternal life because we'll die innocently. But if we end up getting taken to where the enemies are taking us, then we will end up losing our share in the world to come. Darash len hagadol. So the oldest said, Amar Hashem, Mi Bashan Ashiv Bim Tzulot Yam. the pasuk in Tehillim. From the Bashan, I will bring them back from the depths of the sea. Mi Bashan Ashiv, meaning mi ben shinei Aryeh Ashiv. I will bring them back from between the teeth of the lion. Notice the reference to the lion. Ashiv mim tzulat yam. I will bring them back from the depths of the sea. Elu shetuvim bayam, referring to those who allow themselves to drown at the sea rather than being taken into this captivity. Kivan sheshamu yiladot kach, when they heard this, kafzukulan, they jumped into the sea and drowned. What the Gemara essentially is describing is committed suicide in order to avoid being taken into captivity. That, from a purely halachic perspective, that this hard to make that justification in this context, right? You're talking about taking your own life rather than allowing yourself to be killed for the sake of the Torah. So already another level. And Tosfot in the Gemara of Arazara, and this was the Ashkenazic position, there's a machloket between Chachmei Ashkenaz and Chachmei Sfarad, but nonetheless, Omer ben Natam, Hecha sheyireim penya avirum obdeko chavim laavere, at a time when the concern is that the captors will take them for purposes of like prostitution, kigon aydei yisuin shelo yuchal la'amod behem, or suffering that they won't be able to withstand, as hu mitzvah lechabel ba'atzmo. It's a mitzvah. If they take their lives, they're doing on their own, they're doing a mitzvah. It's enormously controversial. The Gemara and Tosu quotes this Gemara in Gittin that we just looked at. Enormously controversial psak, and the Rambam disagrees with it vehemently, but understand the context. Right? This became foundational to whole periods of history. In the Middle Ages, the Crusades, there were moments in history when this was very real for us on multiple levels, unfortunately. This all starts with Daniel. It starts with a world view of Daniel and his friends who teach us from a Tanakh perspective, a concept which only gets articulated hundreds of years later, namely that there is such a concept called Shat Hashmad, of persecution, religious persecution. Religious persecution doesn't exist in Tanakh. Its first moment historically, nationally, is either the experience of Daniel and his friends in Bavel, or the story of Hanukkah. And that's why it's at the end of the book of Daniel. Chazal linked this, of course, and this is a medrash we looked at once before, kind of pulling threads together. Chazal looked at this, and they reflect this in a kind of a story format in the conversation between Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and Yechezkel at the moment that they were challenged with the great statue, and they were told to bow down to it, and they understood this wasn't idolatry, but they also understood that if they didn't stand their ground, stand there and publicly not bow down to it, the result would be that they would be, the people would say, the Israelites also bowed down to it. The very famous medrash, we looked at this once before, Halchul em miyad etzel Yechezkel, the Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, they went and they took counsel with Yechezkel, says the medrash, Amulo, they said to him, Kamosha Mula Daniel, Nizgon Leolo, they said to Yechezkel, the same way they said to Daniel, should we bow down or should we not? And Yechezkel's position was, it's not idolatry, Amalem. Pramukubala Nim Yeshayao Rebbe, I have a tradition from my teacher Yeshayao. Chavi Kimat Ragad Yavozam, go and hide. It's a pasuk in Yeshayao. Hide for a moment until the fury is passed. Meaning, okay, it's not idolatry. It might be perceived as idolatry, whatever it is. I'll give you a better etzah. Instead of standing there and not bowing down to it, why don't you go hide? Sleep in that morning. Don't show up. Just go hide. Amule, so they said to Yechezkel, Ma'at bai diyohon amrin. What do you want the people to say? Hadin salma sagni lekolumaya. Every other nation bow down to this statue. So he said to them, what do you say? They said, we want to be there and refuse to bow down. So we make a public statement. Even though we put our lives at risk, we want to make a public statement. Begin Don Amin Hadin Salma Kolumaya Sagi Levam Yisrael. We want them to be able to say, every nation bow down except Israel. That's what we want them to say. Amar Lehem, so Yechezkel said to them, In Kidatchem, if that's your intention, Hamtinu li ad she'imlach begvura. Let me consult with God. Let me see what God wants. He's a Navi after all. Adal Dichtiv, the Pasuk in Yechezkel, Bau Anashim Mizikne Yisrael, Yidvashat Hashem, Yishvu Lefanai. Okay, so they come to Yechezkel. Yechezkel goes and consults with God, and he says to them the fascinating conversation. Again, it's a medrash, but it reflects such a powerful perspective of Hanani Mishal Vazaya. Amar lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, Yechezkel says to God, Hanani Mishal Vazaya mevakshim leiten nafshama kedushat shemecha, they want to sacrifice their lives to sanctify your name. Notice the terminology. They want to give up their lives. They want to stand there and be put to death in order to sanctify your name. Says Yechezkel to God, Mitkayem at alehan olo, will you save them or not? Right, that's the question. Yechezkel says to God, are you going to save them? Amar lo, God says to Yechezkel, Eini mitkayem alehan, I'm not going to save them. So Yechezkel's response, Adaud, and he quotes a pasuk, Ben Adam deber b'neis azigneis avi matalem ali drosh atiatem ba'im me'achai shekadamtem li lachlim beti v'lisrof echali v'laglot banai livein ha'umot v'chakach atem ba'im l'darsheni. After all you have done to cause the destruction of the temple and to cause the exile, I'm not going to stand with you. V'otasha, and look what happens. V'otasha, at that moment, Yechezkel burst into tears. V'konen, and he begins to lament. V'helil ba'atzmo, v'amar, v'ay l'sonei Yisrael, avda sherit Yehuda. Woe to the remnant of Israel that will be destroyed. In other words, if Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah go through with this, God is not going to be with them. He's not going to save them. And the remnant, the last loyal members of the Jewish people who religiously are going to be lost. These are the last ones from Judah. And this is their fate. He was crying and he was wailing. Then came along Hanani Mishael and Azariah and said, what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu say to you? Amar lehem, Yechezkel said to them, Eino mitkayem alechem, he's not going to save you. Amulo, they said to Yechezkel, Ben mitkayem, ben she'eno mitkayem, anu notnim nafshenu akdushat shmo. Whether he saves us or doesn't, we're giving our lives the sanctification of God's name. In the Medrash, this is the core message of Sefer Daniel. Daniel, Hananya, Mishael, Azariah, who recognized the national connection to the Jewish people, the religious connection to the Brit, was something at a moment when the nations of the world would challenge it, was something that they could defend and were willing to defend and were almost mandated to defend, even at the point of self-sacrifice for the sake of defending their loyalty to the Brit. This is unique. We've never had this in Tanakh. We've had national enemies, political enemies. We've never had an enemy that's come along and said, all we want you to do is give up your loyalty to God, become a Hellenist, become a Greek, and you can live happily ever after. And Daniel and Hananya, Mishael and Azariah, teaching them beyond the political conflict with the external enemy, Antiochus and the king of the north and the king of the south, there's a much bigger piece, which is the internal conflict between the Mashiach Brit and the Maskilei Brit, between those who are loyal to the Brit and those who abandoned it. And into that conflict, says Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, our loyalty is being tested. And that's, in a sense, that's the takeaway of the whole Sefer. From the first parak to the last parak, that's the message of Sefer Daniel. I want to come back to the text for 1 second. Let's see if I can get this to work, because I need that last chapter. Ah, we're in business. All right. Let's go back to the end of the, to chapter 12. And what happens in chapter 12, it says all of this comes to a kind of a conclusion. What's the conclusion? Such a time of trouble as had never happened before, unprecedented. And at that time, your people shall be rescued, the ones that are found written in the book. Now, I'm going to get into the whole question of what book is referring to, but at least in Sefer Malachi, there is a reference to the notion of a kind of a book of those who are righteous being recorded before God, what we call the Sifrei Chaim and Sifrei Meis and Petuchim Lefanav and Rosh Hashanah. V'rabim yishenei admat tafar yakitzu eilu l'chayi olam ve'eilu l'charafot l'dron olam. The world is divided into two people, into two groups, says the Malach to Daniel. Those who shall awake to everlasting life, and those who shall not, those who are righteous and those who are not, those who are loyal to the Brit, maskilim yaziru kizora harakia, those that are wise and loyal, who shall shine like the firmament of the heavens, umatztikei rabim, and who teach this to others, kuchmin l'lamben, which shall shine like the stars for eternity. That's the conflict. Right? That's exactly the conflict. He says it again in Pasuk Tet. This is a time that will purify and purge the righteous and refine the righteous from the wicked. The righteous will understand, the wicked will not. And this conflict is going to internally essentially divide the people between those who are loyal to the beat and those who are not. That's the future destiny of the story of Chanukah. So I come back to the point that I made at the beginning, which is, why is Daniel's last prophecies from the visions of the animals and the horns and the Persian and the different visions that he saw about Alexander the Great and the horns dividing into 10. This prophecy about the aftermath of the war, the Theodokai leading to Antiochus and his conflict with Israel, and suddenly bursts into this conflict between the Mashiebrit and the Yosvebrit and the Maskilebrit. Essentially, what Daniel is saying is everything that we recognize and learned in this Sefer about considerations that are much bigger than me, and for which I have to willing to sacrifice my life, or willing to sacrifice on behalf of the people, the national identity, the religious identity, the notion that this is real, this empowers Israel moving forward. It empowers them to be able to stand against this kind of time period, and gives them the power, it gives them the strength as precedent to be able to stand before the persecutors and say, we will not eat this non-kosher food. Not a yarad v'yaveh. It's not, but it's shat hashmad, but it's a time of persecution. Religious persecution, Daniel taught them what that's about. And so Chanukah becomes not just a component of this last prophecy, but I would say really the whole essence of the Sefer in terms of the message it conveys forward to the people of the story of Chanukah. That's my understanding of the last prophecy in the last chapter, kind of pulls together much of the themes that we've addressed since the beginning of our study of Sefer Daniel. And more or less, that's the last piece of the story. There's one more class that I want to share next week with you. And that addresses what is probably one of the more esoteric but important ideas, which is that Daniel throws at us at the very last chapter a whole new concept, a concept we have yet not seen recorded in Tanakh. and that in addition to everything we discussed today, and that's the concept of Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. That's a, if we're studying Tanakh, that's a unique concept that we need to explore, understand why it is in Tanakh, why it's not in Tanakh. Somebody mentioned before at the beginning of the Shir a conversation about Olam Haba. It dovetails into the concept of why Olam Haba is not a central motif of Tanakh, but is a central motif of rabbinic literature. So I need that one postscript to the Sefer to kind of bring all the pieces together. Next week, we'll come back to what I said earlier, that will be our last class in the study of Sefer Daniel. And I thank you for staying with us on the journey. It's been a long journey, and we've had some technical glitches along the way, but nonetheless, we managed to get through it. And I appreciate your patience and your commitment. And Mizrat Hashem, next week we will bring our study of Sefer Daniel to a close, give you all a 1 week break, and then start again with Sefer Kohelet.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
Fascinating journey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. All right, everybody. Have a wonderful day, morning, afternoon, or evening.